You're listening to Lang FM, the podcast about language and what people do with it. My guest on this episode, fellow Alexander and former fellow conference interpreter at the European Commission.
I'm just a poor boy from another nowhere town.
Alexander Smith.
Just a nowhere boy from another nowhere town.
That's him singing, by the way.
Must be a way whereby God can know my name.
In 2017, Alex hung up his interpreting headphones for good. I jumped at the chance to sit down with him for a chat about his life in interpreting and in music. So here he is, the wonderful Alexander Smith.
Feel the hair above my head. Love is closer than the thought inside my head.
My father was a Scotsman and my mother was Danish. I was born in Fontainebleau in France because my father was stationed there with the RAF, you know, in the early 50s. We were in Singapore for a while because it was still an empire in those days, for which it seems there's much nostalgia, you know.
Oh, yeah, these days. There is.
And then we went back to London. My father worked at Air Ministry and we lived in Ealing in London. And then when my father retired from the Air Force, he worked for GCHQ, you know, the intelligence people. That was in Cheltenham. So we moved to Cheltenham, and I went to school in Cheltenham there. Then as I left school, which was, 1969, my father retired from GCHQ and went to live in Scotland, in Carnoustie, which is near Dundee. And I then went away to university in Newcastle-on-Tyne in the north of England. So it was a bit of a change there.
So how did your parents meet? Did your mother work at an army base?
No, not at all. I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but my father was working in Copenhagen after the war, building up civil aviation at Kastrup, you know. And I think he asked directions of my mother, you know. I think at the station, and said, "Do you speak English?" Well, she said, "A little," because my mother must have been quite interested. Because she said, "But you must meet my father, who does speak quite good English, who studied it." So my father went through this ritual of entertaining her, you know, my grandfather. You know, but he was obviously a lot more interested in my mother than he was
fair enough. He went to the trouble, you know. That's good.
And so, eventually, you know, one thing led to another. They were married, you know, and that must have been 1951, and then I was born in 52. Yeah. And
did you speak the respective languages with your parents, English and Danish?
Not really, because I mean, my mother made a big effort when I was very little to speak Danish to me. Mm. But as soon as I went to school, and don't forget, in England you went to school at age 4.5, I really didn't want to know, because I wanted to be just as cool as those other monolingual kids.
Yeah.
And of course, the idea that my mother was some sort of weirdo, you know, who didn't speak proper, I mean, it used to embarrass me at that age. You know? Well, now I feel embarrassed at the fact of having been embarrassed. But I mean, you know how it is with kids, the pull of conformity is huge.
Infinity in infinity. But I've died up here in your little box, yeah.
We used to go to Denmark every year on holiday as well. So, I mean, I kind of knew Denmark. So I had a feel for Denmark in a childish way. I had a complete... I also had an echo of the language, you know, as a sort of corporeal experience. I mean, you know, so for me, when I came to learning Danish, when I went to university, I went to study Scandinavian studies. Mm. Of course, it was miles easier for me to learn it than for people coming from it scratch, because I already had a feel for it. You know what I mean? Mm. It wasn't really a foreign language, because the whole vibration of it, the whole emotional state which attaches to speaking another language, was something which was completely familiar to me. So, I mean, it was a lot easier for me to learn than than for others, you know, because I know that interpreters, for example, coming to Danish find it very hard.
Oh, yeah.
Not because Danish is intrinsically hard. It's probably...
Well, except the numbers,
it's probably
so
the,
they
yeah,
say.
Yeah, it's probably the easiest language. It's probably the language which is actually closest to English, in fact, you know.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, other than French, but French, you know, that's because, you know, English is full of French. But
yes,
actually, if you look
is,
at it, yeah. I mean, you know, it's Danish is probably the language which is closest to English, which is hardly surprising because it's obviously influenced English, you know.
Yeah.
But of course, acoustically, it's really, really tricky because, I mean, it's very, very difficult to get used to the sound of it and the pronunciation
Absolutely.
Of it, which was never really a problem for me. So I had a bit of a flying start with that.
Mm.
I had quite a good command of the most base and vulgar Danish imaginable. In fact, to the
what they call kitchen Danish.
Well, it was less than that. It was below that.
Yeah.
Although, ironically, I did work in the hospital kitchen, but it was pretty sort of, you know, vulgar, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, I think Danish is like German. But there's a coarse streak to the language, which is incredibly coarse. You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean. But it was kind of fun. I know we used to tease my mother, who had, you know, pretensions of gentility. My brother and I. My brother also, you know, drank from the same spring. So we used to speak to each other in this absolutely sort of, you know, base Copenhagen accent. You know, to my
Is he younger brother or older brother?
He's younger than me.
Yeah.
And it used to irritate my mother no end, of course, which we found extremely amusing. You know. So I was.
So there was no way you were going to become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer,
well,
or whatever.
Well, I don't forget, I come from another planet. It's another era altogether because I was That's brought true. Up in I was at school in the 60s.
Hmm.
And the idea that you would never get a job was just, you know, it was unthinkable. Hmm. Of course you would get a job, you know.
Hmm.
I went to a nice school, a nice middle class background. I was bound to get a job of some sort. There was no thought of that. So you were, in a way, we were much freer. I mean, the thing I was best at school was languages, which interested me most. And I was interested in learning Danish for the simple reason I had a whole bunch of Danish family I couldn't speak to properly, you know.
Yeah.
And my father, who through his work at GCHQ, he actually said to me, look, I wouldn't hesitate to learn a one-off language.
Mm.
He said, because you find you might be the only person who does it.
Yeah.
And because most of us, you know, and I went to university and you know, my contemporaries said, what the bloody hell are you learning Danish for? You know, everyone speaks bloody English, a complete waste of time.
Well, even back then, yeah.
Yeah. Oh. And, well, the Danes certainly already then were, you know, would and could speak English.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as it turned out, I mean, I got my job here on the strength of the Danish, which was because they were desperate for people who knew Danish, you know. And, when, you know, so my father's advice came out trumps, absolutely, you know.
Mm.
So it just goes to show, I mean... You know, you don't really know, really. I mean, it seems to make a lot of sense to learn the standard languages.
Yeah.
In my day, at least,
the
standard
yeah.
languages were French and German.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, German is being pushed aside by Spanish now as a second language because, I don't know, people go on holiday to Spain and...
Or retire in Spain.
And people say it's easier or something, which I don't believe, actually.
No,
you know. But, I mean, there's no such thing as an easy language. I mean,
True.
That's just absurd, you know. So I regret that because I really enjoyed studying German at school. We learned French from the earliest age.
So no classics then?
Oh, I did Latin, obviously. I did Latin throughout.
Yeah. Okay, you had to, I suppose.
But I've forgotten everything. I mean, I can't even read an inscription. I mean, I can sort of, you know, deduce it from Italian and French, but I can't really read Latin, you know. But we did Latin, you know, around the clock. I also studied Greek for a while, classical Greek, so I could read it. I can't understand it, but I can read it.
At least you can read it.
And even the French was studied in a very, very old-fashioned way. I mean, it was studied almost in the same way as a dead language.
Yeah, because it was much more difficult to travel, I mean, in those days, I imagine.
We had a school trip to France, I remember, as something quite magical.
Oh,
because we were twinned with a school in La Flèche, which is on Le Loire. It's down that way near La Loire.
Huh.
And it was called La Prytanée Militaire de La Flèche. My school, which is rather pompous, self-important establishment, saw itself as having a sort of military aspect to it.
Yeah.
And this Prytanée Militaire was actually a school specially for the children of serving officers and so on. So,
okay.
So we were jumelés with them, and I remember going there and thinking it was just absolutely marvellous. But the whole business of foreignness and foreign languages is always absolutely incredibly intriguing, incredibly exciting to me. I mean, I don't know how you could not be fascinated by it.
You
know?
Degree, yes.
You know, and I mean, then I went on when I at school, the three subjects which I took, you know, for leaving school were English, French, and German. And then I left school and I went to a university in Newcastle there where they had a big Scandinavian studies department because of the natural links with Scandinavia. They had a big Scandinavian department there, and I was very pleased to go there. And it was great because I was very spoiled as well because I had a whole Scandinavian department and they didn't have that many students. So in final honours Danish, there was me and another guy who was a mature student who was about 10 years older than me who'd married a Danish girl, you know. And so it was just the two of us. So it was like, you know, it must be like being an only child in China or something. We were incredibly spoiled. The whole department was completely devoted to us. Yeah. You
know, which is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? You know, when you think of the fact that, you know, the Scandinavians ruled much of England, you know, and there's a huge influence there. I mean, that's it makes perfect sense, really, from a language history point of view. I know, for example, people who study the history of English seriously not only study Anglo-Saxon, but also study Old Icelandic, you know. So, I mean, which is something I studied too, incidentally, at university. Part of my course involved the study of Old Icelandic. But that was literally like Latin because, it's contrary to Danish, which has become very simplified. It's highly inflected, you know, there's conjugations and declensions, agogo, you know. So we had to learn all of those things, but of which, of course, I can remember not a thing. I mean, I went on mission to Iceland a few years ago, and I was really excited at that, you know. But I was very disappointed to discover I really couldn't understand it, and I couldn't really even read a newspaper. I mean, you know, I could read a newspaper in languages I don't really know, like Italian and Spanish.
I mean, could you read the script? Because the script already is quite interesting.
Oh, no. Well, they have a few letters which are slightly different. I recognize those letters, you know. There's a th and th. But, I mean, no, I can recognize the letters. But it's just that, you know, I was surprised that I didn't understand more, you know.
But what was the plan? I mean, did you have a plan studying and then moving on to...
Well, no. I mean, in fact, I was very interested in doing, you know, a number of research projects which I had in mind. There's one
linguistic history
projects I had in mind because I was very interested in the links between Denmark and Scotland because of my parents, you know, and there's very interesting historical links there. I was certainly interested in place names, for example, which is quite fascinating.
Because it
is, not only do you have Scandinavian place names, you know,
you
know, which in England, but in Scotland, even in the Gaelic speaking areas, you have Scandinavian place names. So there's a quite clear influence of Scandinavian on the Gaelic speaking regions as well, which is quite intriguing, you know. And then, of course, you have Orkney and Shetland, which were very specifically Scandinavian. So I was very interested in researching those dialects in order to be able to trace the exact Scandinavian origin of all of that. As a sort of fill-in job, I got a job in a hospital. It was an old people's home in Copenhagen. And, you know, that was piles of fun because I was in with a lot of young people. It was, you know, the early 70s, and it was it was just an absolute gas, you know. And I used to work there do the Sunday shift sometimes. And I remember they had a little garden there, and I was just kicking my heels a bit in this garden. There was a Sunday newspaper, and I never used to get the daily Sunday newspaper because, I mean, there were massive, great things. I could never get through them. They were quite expensive for me then, you know. Yeah. But no one seems to want this paper, so I purloined it and took it home, and I was reading it. There was a little article which said, Dansk et problem barn for EF. Danish is a problem for the European communities because they couldn't find people. And there was a whole.
So this was in the run up to the.
This was just after. Just after I graduated, and I just went back to the job which I'd had as a student when I had been in Denmark because I enjoyed it so much. So this little article said that Danish was a problem for the EU, and there were the whole of it was before the interpretation service was trying to recruit people. They were holding a meeting at the information center in Copenhagen, and I thought, well, I might as well turn up and see what it is. And I came straight from work. That's I had a shift which ran from 6 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock, and this was in the afternoon. So I came straight from work, and you got to realize it was 1974. It was still flared trousers and long hair, and I turned up there, and of course I thought, oh my God, everyone's wearing suits. This is a serious. It wasn't just a sort of casual inquiry. It was a serious event. Anyway, when I just ploughed ahead with it. They gave us what I subsequently realized was an aptitude test. And the guy spoke to me in Danish for a bit. And he said, well, could you repeat that? Well, yeah, that was easy. I just had to repeat what he said. It was quite obvious. Then they asked me to do some French. My French wasn't really up to much.
Danish or English?
The guy spoke a bit of Danish, and I had to take I took a few notes, like an aptitude test, and I gave it back. But, it was dead easy. I mean, there was no issue, really. Yeah,
came naturally.
And then I had to do some French, which, I didn't know the words so well, so I immediately started lying. So I had all the rights and conservative instincts, and I managed to get through that. And then I realized subsequently the guy who gave me the interview was Flüchner, and Flüchner said, well, if you come down to Brussels and do the stage there, you'll pick up a lot of French, that'll be fine. In November, which was just the next month, really. Wow. And so I came down to do the stage in November of 1974.
So moving to Brussels wasn't a big problem at all.
I was really young. I was only 22. The whole thing was just like, don't forget, it was a different kind of era where it was like, I was thinking I was just going to be just another cool thing I was going to do in this fabulous swathe I was going to be cutting through life, So I just kind of rocked up in Brussels, blundered my way through the various offices, and then went and did the course, completely protected by my innocence,
it's a good thing, maybe.
Yeah. And then we got a bit of a rude awakening with the stage, because it was based on the old French idea of intimidating people,
breaking you. Yeah, as you could say,
but I mean, I've been doing exams forever, so I was quite used to doing exams. It didn't really worry me too much, but it was quite tough. You had to do a test every. It was a 6-month course. You had to do a test every 2 months.
Yeah,
and then I passed the final test. It must have been at the end of April 75, and then I started work as an auxiliaire, as it was in those days, in May of 1975. I finished the stage. I went over to England in just before Christmas. Right. Just after Christmas, we were married in 74. And then I brought my wife over with me. We finished the stage. And then I started work in 75. We moved into a swanky apartment on the strength of my fantastic salary.
So they didn't manage to break you after all. You were successful in the
final. Well, no, I mean, I think I was protected by my innocence because when it came to taking exams later on, I found them much more intimidating because I knew the people, I knew what was going on. I mean, because don't forget, I didn't really think I was going to stay. I mean, I just thought, we'll do this,
see how it goes.
Yeah, and don't forget, it was before there was any idea of a sort of crisis or anything.
Yeah.
There was a sort of oil crisis in 73, wasn't there? And that was the beginning of the end of the halcyon days where, no one worried about stuff like that. We were incredibly free when I think about it, But, after that, things got tougher. And then it went through to the 80s, where you got a whole new kind of Thatcherite generation who were much more kind of structured in what they wanted to do, We still had a kind of slightly amateur approach. I think we were better for it. I mean, some of the interpreters I knew were absolutely brilliant. I don't think I've ever come across anyone like Tony Braddy. Was absolutely brilliant. You know, Richard Appleby, who died very sadly, was absolutely brilliant interpreter. And they were part of that generation where, you know, they didn't decide at the age, some tender age, what they wanted to be when they grew up, was to be interpreters. They just happened to know the languages and happened to be good at it, you know.
And then interpreting happened to them.
Exactly. Absolutely, you know. But
you did pick up French then when you stayed in Brussels.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But French, I had studied. I mean, I'd studied it at university. Mm. It's just that, you know, I'd forgotten it. And, you know, it's one of those things, if you don't practice it, you lose it. And it had been completely overlaid by my Danish, because I'd thrown myself into this Danish thing, which I think psychologically played a very important role in my life, because it gave me a kind of an alternative identity. Because, you know, I went to this rather self-important school in that slightly kind of constipated environment of English, sort of, you know, that English world, which is sufficient unto itself, you know. I was able to sort of, you know, reinvent myself, really, now, you know. I think a lot of people do that when they study language. They discover it's a medium for kind of reinventing themselves through the medium of a different language, a different culture, you know. I think it's a fantastic opportunity. Of course, as a result of which you see the world completely differently. Yeah. You know, other people may do things differently, but though it's different, it's equally valid.
But how would you say interpreting was different back then? It's maybe a lazy question, but still, I think, interesting. Well, there were fewer languages, first of all.
There were fewer languages, and it was smaller, and people knew each other much more. It was much more intimate.
For the delegates and the interpreters, was there more contact between the two than there is nowadays? Did you mean among the interpreters?
Yeah, I don't remember socializing as such with the delegates, but of course they were easier to see.
Yeah.
You could establish eye contact much more. The whole thing was much more intimate, you know. Whereas now, if you're working in the English booth, I mean, you're working for all and sundry. I mean, it's difficult to have quite that same sort of, you know, intuitive umbilical link to the delegation, which you know, we had when we started, you know. And of course, the other huge difference is English, isn't it? Because in our day, French
was very much a foreign language.
French was far and away the dominant language, you know. So we did acres and acres of French, including a lot of really bad French, like you guys have to do a piles of bad English, you know. We had to do...
It doesn't repeat itself, after all.
But, you know, I think from a professional point of view, I mean, we were far better off because... I mean, for starters, an auxiliaire, as I started, I mean, you worked every day for a year, and then I took another test and became a temporaire, and I worked every day, and you worked, and you actually worked every day, and we were two in the booth. So you work, so that's a deep sort of instinct for it, you know, that's simply the moving sort of... center aspect of it was inculcated in us from the earliest times. So I think we had a huge advantage, you know, from that point of view.
Because there's lots of routine just in
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Most, I mean, you couldn't do it if it weren't for routine. It'd be impossible. Imagine having to reinvent the wheel.
Adding more languages, was it just out of curiosity? Were you told to learn?
No, not really. But I always felt duty bound to add German because I'd studied German at school, and I'd always liked German, and I really enjoyed reading German literature and stuff. But my German was a bit iffy. And I, of course, it was difficult for me to go away to study, you know, because I would have liked to have gone, I don't know, to Heidelberg or something and study. But I couldn't actually do that because, you know, by that time, you know, we had small children and that, it wasn't really practicable. So I never got the chance to go away, but I studied it a lot, you know, reading and listening and watching TV and stuff for myself. And then I ended up taking a test. I asked them to give me a test because I really wanted to get the driving license.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do the test, but I wanted to feel that it wasn't just my responsibility, you know?
Yes.
And funny enough, it was Tony Braddy who was the person at my test there. And Tony said, well, it sounded very convincing. I'm not quite sure whether it was exactly what the original said, but it's very difficult sometimes to compare. So he kind of saw right through me. But, I mean, German was a challenge, I must say. I found it, you know, quite. I get avalanched occasionally, you know, by it. But now, I mean, you know, the word order thing, I hardly notice. Mm. I know it sounds ridiculous because people say, you know, the word order must be really difficult. I don't notice it because you get so used to the rhythms of the language that, I mean, it's a completely. Not as though Germans, you know, bust the gut putting their verbs at the end of the sentence. It's a perfectly normal and natural thing, you know.
And you learn to anticipate and know where the speaker's going.
Of course,
going,
because thankfully no one's terribly original, you know what I mean? Because how can they be if everyone's learnt language by copying it? So, I mean, you know, so once you get in the natural cadences of the language.
Is that something that you notice increasingly, that people aren't really original, that topics keep popping up that people tend to say the same thing?
Well, I think so, isn't it? I mean, obviously there are subjects which you know less about, but, you know, gradually, simply by dint of doing them, you become more familiar with them. Mm. I mean, you know perfectly well, as long as you're even remotely an expert, but certain things, you know, keep coming round and you get used to them. You know, I often think that about languages. You don't really learn languages, you just get used to them, really, don't you?
Yeah.
You
know? So which other languages did you add to?
Then after that, I added Swedish, and that was at the specific request of the head of booth at the time, who was Tony Bradley.
So that was for the Swedish.
Not Tony Bradley, Tony Scott. And Tony rang me up just I was at a meeting one day. And said, "Do you want to learn Swedish? We want you to learn Norwegian or Swedish."
Yes,
he said at the time, and. Well, I said, well, I think I prefer to do Swedish for the simple reason it's more different, you know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And that was it. And I did a course here. I was with a bunch of Danes, actually, mostly. We went up to Sweden for a couple of weeks. Mm. It's like a, you know, it's like preparing people for the front when you're running out of recruits. You know what I mean?
Get them ready. We got
2 weeks of bayonet practice and got sent to the front. But I mean, it was a real challenge to start with. Again, I got very used to doing Swedish. In a way, I mean, they're in a way that it's culturally different from Denmark, and they have a culture of public speaking. And so often they're, as it were, objectively speaking, better speakers.
Mm.
And so sometimes I've found actually the Swedish easier to do than the Danish. Although I understand, I mean, if I were drunk and you kicked me awake, because I could understand Danish, but you know, Swedish, other people's conversations are still a bit, you know, come see, come sir. But I mean, I got a lot of fun out of doing the Swedish, also because I'd studied Scandinavian studies, and it's one of the things I'd always meant to do.
You had a very good foundation, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, Danish gives you kind of a running start because, you know, obviously a lot of the words are, if not the same, at least equivalent, you know? Yeah. But there's a lot of different words. There are fuz and me, and the way they say things, the way they put their thoughts together is actually quite different, you know? And you've got to learn that whole new kind of emotional furniture which goes with a new language, you know? Mm. But no, I got a lot of fun out of that. And I think one of the things I really enjoyed was overcoming the typically Danish prejudices about Sweden, which is basically that Siberia starts in Helsingborg, you know. You know what I mean? Which is, you know, quite radically unfair. And I enjoyed Sweden hugely, you know. Yeah. Now, I've been to Sweden a few times on holiday with my wife. My wife actually prefers Stockholm to Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose it is, you know, in a way, quite breathtakingly beautiful city, you know. I mean, it doesn't have quite the same urban buzz as Copenhagen has, but it's a classic beauty as opposed to a jolie laid, which is,
yeah,
you know.
Much so.
But So, I mean, I got a lot out of the Swedish. And then in the end, I sort of came clean and felt I really ought to sort of work on the Dutch because I'd lived here all these years.
Yeah.
And, I understood, you know, a significant percentage of what was said.
Yeah.
And then I got to the point where I thought, you know, it was almost, you know, better for me to do it direct than to take the relay.
Yeah.
And so I said I'd do it, and they sent me to... Well, I went to the KUL in Leuven. I could stay at home with the family.
Yeah,
I went
just
to
around the corner. Basically.
I went to the KUL every day for 3 months, you know, and I just filled my day with an assortment of lectures and then I came back and did it. So that was the Dutch, and then of course I added Norwegian just for a sort of, you know, sort of boyish desire to have a complete set of Scandinavian. I did Norwegian very much on the cheap because I said they didn't want to pay for any sort of course for me. Mm. I said, well, just send me to Norway for a week. Oh, and I went to the university in Oslo for a week and did exactly the same thing. I went to lectures every day for a week and tried to sort of simply, you know,
soak it up,
you know. And then I've done it. The most fun Norwegian meeting I did was the TETUC Congress a couple of years ago in Paris, where suddenly realizing. They started nervously speaking Norwegian. When they realized it was kind of working, they all suddenly popped out of the woodwork. They hunted packs, you know. So I got quite a lot of quite scary Norwegian. But what they do have, which is more tricky, is they have a sort of respect for dialect. They don't. That's to say, you know, it's not seen as being poor form to speak dialect. So, which it is, you know, certainly in English or other languages. Mm. Come to a meeting and speak dialect is a bit sort of not really quite the thing, is it?
But
in Norwegian, the dialect enjoys a considerable status. You can get people speaking. God, blimey, I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you do work with from Dutch, but sometimes you get people speaking a dialect in a Flemish dialect, which leaves you gasping. Yeah. You know, and they don't realise really because
it's an agricultural or trade union, for example.
So that could leave you gasping. It's a little bit like that with Norwegian, you know, because if they speak in a very, the more formal it is, the easier it is, because the more like Danish it is, really, you know. Knowing Danish is a bonus, but it's also a handicap because, you know, the idea that Norwegian is like some sort of, you know, subprime version of Danish is ridiculous, you know, because it's its own world and its own, you know, raison d'être, you know, its own way of being and its own, you know, emotional states which go with it, which are different, you know. You know,
it's always,
you know what it's like sometimes, you know, people are not used to interpretation, get quite excited about they would get quite excited about it and say, hey, I've got to speak Norwegian now. Mm. It's quite,
see how quite good the interpreter
is. Yeah, well, a lot of checking goes on, but I'm an old dog. I know how to cover my tracks. You know?
I'd like to talk about music a little bit.
Go on then.
I could just ask, how did you get into music? But I mean, did you grow up in a musical family? Were your parents?
Well, my father played a bit. He played the piano a bit, you know. Mm.
But more as a general skill that many people had, or
well, no, I was sent to piano lessons, you know,
because I came
from a nice middle class home, that's what you did. And I went to the Ismar Govet School of Pianoforte in Ealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a poor piano student, really, because
wasn't in it.
Well, it's not that I was, you know, I always liked it. I just never got around to practicing for whatever reasons of laziness, distraction, you know.
Yeah, same, yeah.
And then I used to go down there and I have my knuckles wrapped by the piano teacher. Mm. You haven't touched the piano once this week, have you, Alex? Don't just look down and shrug.
Yeah,
but
I've been there.
But I mean, also because I mean, I always had a good ear, so instead of reading the notes properly, I used to copy what she played as well, which is quite nice in one way. But it means, I mean, my sight reading is abysmal, you know, and still is, you know. But then, with adolescence, I must have been about 16 where I discovered. Don't forget, when I was 16. That was 1967. I mean, it was like the apotheosis of the rock and roll century, you know what I mean? And I got really into blues. Mm. Then I started learning to play the blues for myself, you know? Mm.
That was still on the piano then, right?
That was still on the piano. Oh. And I had a Memphis Slim album for all you, you know, blues aficionados out there, which I virtually copied off the record.
Yeah.
In those days, there weren't any of the modern age. You simply had to put it on the turntable and listen to it, take it off, play it, put it on the turntable.
Right. But,
to, to the point when I was doing those sort of boogie woogie shapes with my left hand to my parents' distraction, to the point where they actually locked the piano to prevent me playing it. So, you know, most parents are very, very keen that their children should take an interest in music. But it got to the point where my parents really couldn't bear it any longer. It used to sort of limit my playing of boogie woogie bass shapes to certain hours of the day.
So it was more because of it was not because it was blues and they thought that wasn't a good style of music.
No, I don't know. Although my dad used to say, why don't you play something with a melody instead of that vamp, you know?
Yeah.
That, you know. Yeah. But I don't think they were ideologically opposed to it as such. It's just that it was just really, really tiresome to listen to after a while, you know?
Yeah.
But so I was able to play a pretty decent sort of boogie, a few standard things. I played quite decently boogie woogie piano. I went away to university. There was a piano there, you know, in the students' union. I used to play there. People used to come up to me and say, "Hey, do you want to join my band?" In those days,
I was going to ask about that, if you played in any ensembles.
And I said no, because in those days I was very into mountaineering and climbing, and most of my weekends were taken up sort of going to the Lake District, going up to Scotland, Northumberland, going climbing and hiking and stuff like that. So I said no, which was a shame, really, because I don't know what ever happened to those bands that were formed at Newcastle University then. But some of them may be famous now, but I mean, I let it pass me by.
You missed out on
that. There was a couple of other people. And we formed a little band, you know, which was, when I think back, it was absolutely awful. We were useless, you know. But I mean, I fronted the band, and by then I was playing the harmonica as well, because actually it was while I was in Denmark, there was another guy turned up at this hospital where I worked.
Yeah.
It was an English guy whose mother was Danish, so we had a similar background.
Yeah, and he would.
And he was an art. He was an ex-art student. He was pretty. He was a bit more sort of, you know, radically alternative than I was. A guy called Stephen Goodfellow, and he could play blues harmonica. And I always play the harmonica a bit because my father had given me a harmonica for my birthday once, and I played it. But I only played kind of Scottish type tunes, you know. And I hadn't learned. Really learned to play the blues style, which of course normal mouth organ playing is based on blowing, whereas blues is based upon sucking. And of course, once I learned that, of course there was no holding me back, because it was just absolutely tremendous.
That went off.
And of course, you know, I mean, there was a wonderful thing for showing off to girls and stuff like that, you know. You know,
I mean, Mick Jagger does it to great effect, you know, until this very day.
Yeah, well, really, it's about time he grew out of that nonsense. But so I mean, I fronted this band on harmonica. And anyway, it went on from there, gradually. I always played. I played with different people in different combinations. I got a Fender Rhodes piano, and I started writing my own songs. And then we recorded some songs. I did a little single back in, it must have been 79, 80.
Yeah.
And then on from there, really. And then I wrote more and more songs, and I played in different bands and stuff. And it, you know, became the most natural thing in the world, you know. So,
but you never pursued a professional or semi-professional career.
Well, it's not really a good bet, music, is it?
No.
I mean, I had this job here, which was just, you know, which I always enjoyed, which I never had to bust a gut. It paid all the bills and some.
Yeah.
And I got to travel. And I mean, that's a genuine and sincere love is his language. So, I mean, to spend your life, you know, doing something you love and it paying the bills is really the definition of happiness, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You know, that's what, what's his name, the guy who just died recently, Tom Petty said. And I couldn't see, I couldn't agree more. And music, I made a couple of albums which I think are absolutely of decent professional quality.
They are. Yeah, I can buy
that. I tried marketing them a little bit, but I don't think they ever really. I think it's a bit of a niche, really, and
It takes a lot of work marketing that and doing it, even just semi-professionally.
Yeah, it's a tremendous. It's a full-time job, you know, and it's not even a job I'm very good at. You know?
Yeah.
So marketing yourself is very awkward, I think, as well. And psychologically, is very awkward, you know. Say, hey, I listen to me, I'm great. I mean, I've never been very good at that. It may be just, you know, false modesty or something, but I mean, I've always found that very, very awkward, you know. But anyway, I've been then more recently, Andy Andy Upton recruited me to Bahorn, the folk group.
There was a wee cooper who lived in Fife,
nickety-nackety-doo-doo-doo,
and he has gotten a gentle wife.
I will you all see how to do in
because I had a whole background in folk music because, again, when I was a young man, my first ever job, I bought an accordion. Don't forget, I was actually brought up on Scottish music because my father was a Scotsman. And so I got this accordion to play basically Scottish country dance music, you know. So I'm kind of steeped in that stuff, you know. And when I was recruited to play in Mahorn, of course, it opened up a whole new world of songwriting in a folk genre, which I've got a huge amount of fun on. I think that's my real strength is songwriting. I mean, at the risk of sounding, you know, self-important, I think I'm quite a good songwriter. Mm-hmm. I'm an okay musician, but compared to real musicians, I'm pretty sort of average, you know. Yeah. But people say, wow, you're great, but I know deep down, I'm okay.
You're not a virtuoso, but you don't have to be.
No, it's fine. Well, that's another very interesting thing. I mean, virtuoso. I mean, I think the thing is, what touches people, I think, is songs.
Yeah.
I don't think people are impressed by a virtuoso performance.
By fast fingers, yeah, for example.
But I really think what touches people is something completely different, which is a song, you know. And that's something which interests me far, far more, you know. And I'd rather spend my time, you know, working on songwriting than, you know, going through the shapes of my fingers till I'm blue in the face.
Exercising scales.
Yeah, you know what I mean, you know.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I've been doing. I've been doing a lot of work with folk songs. In fact, I've got, now that I've retired, I'm spreading my wings a bit because I've got another group going, Elixir, it's called.
Yeah.
And it keeps you young, that's the idea. Yeah. You know? because there's some things which is difficult to do with Bahorn, because Bahorn's good at certain types of things. Mm.
It's a particular genre.
Yeah, but the thing I want to do is more a kind of crossover between blues and folk, altogether a bit more syncopated, a bit funkier.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get together a group of people to play that stuff for me with the hope of doing an album, you know, which would be quite nice, you know. And then I've got my old rock and roll band, About Time Too, you know. So it's not that easy to get these people together, but we're still the best of friends. And I think they would recognise that, you know, between us, we did some fantastic work on those albums.
Yeah.
And I think they I'm so pleased that they are as proud of it as I am, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You
know?
I'm okay, you're okay, that's all you got to say, girl. If I had my way, you would just go away. Out there in dreamy land, you think that I'm the man who is your biggest fan, some kind of Peter Pan. The universe is expanding. Infinity in infinity.
Got to be careful because I don't want to spread myself too thin either. You know?
I still want to enjoy, you know.
Well, you know, I really used to think people were just, you know, whistling in the dark when they said, "Oh, you know, you wonder how you ever had time to work." Well, that's exactly what's happened, really.
Yeah.
You know, for example, now when I'm finished with you, I'm off to a sculpture class which I've taken which you know, enables me to sort of pursue some artistic fantasies I had, you know, and that that thing is growing, you know, hugely, you know, because I've managed to, by mouthing off to the teacher, I've got him, you know, enthused in my project, which means I'm kind of stuck with it now, you know.
now you have to deliver.
In fact, that's the only, being somebody who by nature is actually very idle, the only way I can get anything done is by shooting my mouth off and then finding I'm committed, you know, because the alternative is a total loss of face, really.
Yeah, exactly. But that works for me as well. Yeah, exactly. So you actually find that you're not falling into a deep black hole after retirement.
Because not
they,
at
they
all.
They offer training as well for people who are about to retire.
No, I followed that. Yeah. I followed that. And
I think
was,
you have to, even. I think it's mandatory.
I followed that, and it was quite interesting, but you know, so far, you know, I feel actually like it's a whole new lease of life. You know, the only thing which is different is that, you know, I mean, when you're young, your future compensates for current inadequacies, doesn't it? Whereas now I don't really have that sort of money in the bank anymore. Yeah. No, I hope to be able to do some really interesting things. I think the thing to do is, I mean, it's one of those things which is very easy to say, but enjoy it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I mean, when I think back to my life in music, much of the time is spent on projections into the future. When we've got this, when we've done that, then this will be that and that. Yeah. But you spend a whole lifetime like that, you know, and you kind of miss your life, really, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what I'm trying to do is concentrate now is on, you know, enjoying it for what it is now. We had a Bahorn rehearsal last night, for example, and we came up with some great ideas. We had a great laugh together, and that in and of itself is an end and a purpose, you know.
And that's the great thing about making music with other people, you know, these coming up with things together.
Because you know, because you knock. But I don't know, I think it's like conversation. How often have you come up with an idea in conversation which you'd never thought of before?
Yeah.
Well, you sat there, you know, in your own little box, you know. I mean, you know, the same things keep coming around. But you know, when you have the stimulus of other people, suddenly something comes around you never realised you'd thought before. I mean, that's really, in fact, the whole business of conversation is really interesting, because I was speaking to a friend of mine from university who'd worked for Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
And he retired there, and he went to those, you know, they have the equivalent retirement lectures, and they were talking about what's the best way of fending off, you know, Alzheimer's and general, mental deterioration. And people would say, you know, Sudoku or chess or something, but no, the most important thing is conversation. The fact that what the other person says, you know, stimulates you to come up with something. The mere fact that you asked me a few sort of seemingly obvious questions, you know, stimulates this, stream of consciousness, you know what I mean? You know.
That's exactly what I wanted, I'm fine.
Just a nowhere boy from another nowhere town.
You will have noticed that I really enjoy talking to Alex. I don't usually include my side of the interview in my episodes anymore. In this case, however, it seemed like a good fit. And also, I set up my audio recorder incorrectly, but that's another story. Pour la petite histoire, as Alex would say, he was there when I went on my very first interpreting trip abroad, what we in SCIC call a mission. The trip was to Reggio Emilia, and I remember thinking, wow, what interesting characters they have in this interpreting service.
All that I do it in love's name.
By the way, the music extracts throughout this episode are from two bands that Alexander's been involved in: About Time and their album Songs from the Underground, and folk band Bahorn. Their album is called Binary, and the other band members and fellow SCIC interpreters are Elise Doherty, Jane McBride, and Andy Upton.
When you are chosen.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, please spread the word. I'd love for you to recommend the podcast to anyone and everyone you think might be interested. The podcast website is www.langfm.audio, and there's also a Twitter account @langfmpod. Do say hi, and until then, goodbye.